Coming up, we got Tom Haverstraw talking about Bam Adebayo's 83-point game and some more amazing things that happened this week in the NBA. And then later, Aaron Gordon joins me from the Denver Nuggets to discuss Denver's season, his injury recovery, and how he's become the player that he has with his player development. That's all coming up right now. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We got a good one today talking about Bam Adebayo's 83 points and some more amazing things that happened this week in the NBA. Joining me, Tom Haverstraw. Tom, how are you?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. You set the internet ablaze with your article on Yahoo this week where you wrote about how Bam Adebayo's 83-point game deserves an asterisk. And you get a ton of people responding saying, oh, you're an idiot, or I agree, without clicking the article, only for you to make the argument for every single instance of a player scoring 70-plus points of why that game deserves an asterisk. We have to start off there because we're talking about amazing things this week in the NBA. First off, just with the game itself, I tune in, end of the third quarter. I was like, he's got a chance to hit 70, middle of the fourth quarter. He might actually surpass Kobe. They went for it. And just my first thoughts, Tom, I didn't have fun watching the fourth quarter. That I don't think this whole, you know, shebang this week about, oh, this blame the nerds, this is their fault, I think it's ridiculous. I don't like watching free throw contests, but the accomplishment itself was amazing and is a testament of Bam's development as a scorer, as a shooter, adding the three-point shot, going from just a hustle guy when he entered the NBA out of Kentucky as a first-round pick to become a guy capable of even sniffing 80 points. I mean, the fact that it actually happened is remarkable. So I personally didn't enjoy the free throw contest in the fourth quarter with all the fouling, but everything else leading up to that that I watched afterwards, after the fact, was pretty amazing. And so big ups to Bam Adebayo. I'm happy for him with his story and his background. But the fourth quarter itself, I can understand why people didn't enjoy it, because I didn't like the free throw contest either.
Yeah, totally. But the first quarter, 31 points, and just amazing. Everything was working. It was incredible. Yes. It was a heater among heaters. And I think that's the unfortunate thing about this, is that once he started ramping up towards 60, 70, and people were posting about it, and it started getting, growing steam, that's when the game was at its worst, right? Because then they're triple teaming him in the backcourt to force him not to get the ball, and he's just going through guys, and they're fouling to extend the game to make sure he has as many bites at the apple to break the record, or Kobe's record. That's the thing that I think it inspired me to write this article at Yahoo, was that happened in Wilt's game too. So the idea that there's something off about this, or it felt like cheating, or it felt wrong that this Miami Heat team was intentionally fouling there late in the game, or that they were getting triple teamed and he was getting so many free throws. This is what happened with Wilt's 100-point game too. And so you can go, and Kobe Bryant was the opposite issue, was Sam Mitchell, the coach, refused to double team while he's getting torched by Kobe Bryant. And if you read the oral history at ESPN.com, like, all the Raptors players were like, I had no idea why we had that defensive alignment when we refused to double Kobe Bryant while he's getting 80 points. And so every scoring game like this, you can point to things that were discrediting on some level, but that's what happens when you have 80 point games, 100 point games.
Some of the ones in your story were a little bit of a stretch, like the Dame one. There's really nothing to poke at in that one. It's a little bit of a stretch, but that's why with Bam, I first of all, if you have a chance to surpass Kobe Bryant, you should go for it. And I respect the Heat for going for it. I respect Spo for challenging the play and doing the shenanigans that they did, because history won't remember everything that happened necessarily. People who were there might remember it, but he's going to go down in the history books. Wilt Chamberlain, Bam Adebayo. I mean, and then Kobe Bryant. It's actually happened. He surpassed Kobe. But it did create this conversation. If Bam had stopped at 70 and subbed out of the game in the middle of the fourth quarter, I don't think this conversation would even be a thing at all this week. There'd be no debate. It would have just been a pure, oh my God, Bam Adebayo, his development. Oh my God, it's amazing. Bam Adebayo was taking the leap. That it would have stopped there. But because of everything that happened to get him past 80, that's what put us in a position where we are now with all the free throws, all the shenanigans, all the fouling, everything that happened. That kind of put a little bit of a smear on what happened. But you can't, but I can't blame the Heat for doing that, because I think if you have a chance to go for it, you should go for it. And so I respect the Heat for doing what they did in that regard. But I feel like I'm split in the middle here, because I am. That's where I fall here. I understand the side that's like, this is representative of how the game has degraded. But I also am like, well, wait a minute. As you said, Tom, this happened when Wilt scored 102. What has actually changed? They were trying to get him to 100. We've seen players push to become the scoring champion final game of the regular season. Like, it's happened before. I'd love to see it happen again before the end of the regular season. That's how I would just go for it, right? If you have a chance.
Yeah, I think we actually might see a player beat this record for the rest of the season because of all of the depleted rosters around the league, like the Wizards. I wouldn't be surprised. Like, I wouldn't be shocked. Isn't that crazy to say that I wouldn't be shocked if this happens again with another player? Because, look, Bam Adebayo, the fact that he did this, Bam doing this, is so extraordinary. Crazy. I think it's the most unlikely basketball feat in NBA history. Like, I think it is the most unlikely, surprising, shocking. Just the probability of a guy whose career high, Kevin, was 41 entering this game, had 83 crazy points. I had a great... So it is the largest gap between a player's highest scoring game of his career and his second highest scoring game of his career. I did the research on this. David Thompson, when he had 73 in the final game of the regular season to take the scoring title away from George Gervin, his previous high was 44, a gap of 29. And Bam Adebayo, it's not just an increase of 30, an increase of 35, 42 points above his previous norm. And the Donovan Mitchell one, as you see on the screen here, that 71-point game was in an overtime game. Bam was in a regulation game in a win, and it's different than Devin Booker when he got 70 because they got blown out in that game, and it was just, right, he had 70 points, but it was they were trying to get him to 70 in a losing fashion in a lost season. This was not that. And I want to pull this up because my former colleague at ESPN, he had this great, great demonstration of how wild it is that Bam Adebayo had 83 points when his previous high was 41. His 83 point game was 8.5 standard deviations away from his career average. Based on career averages, it's like Patrick Mahomes passing for 915 yards. Think about that. Imagine if Pat Mahomes had not threw for 900 yards. That's the equivalent of what we just saw with Bam going from, he hadn't had 32 more than 32 points all season. He had never done 41. Or more than 41, and then he ends up with 83. It's the equivalent of Pat Mahomes throwing for 900 yards in a football game. So it is just mind-blowing. I think that's part of the reason why fans are having such a hard time with this. There's the Kobe factor, certainly. There's the factor of the free throws at the end of the game. But I think what also is a factor here is we can't wrap our minds around it's Bam Adebayo who did it. And that when you can't wrap your mind around it, you have to put in different rationales or different theories or different explanations that might make sense in our brain, because it really is breaking everyone's brain, including mine, including yours, that on this day we are saying Bam Adebayo had 83 points in an NBA game.
I mean, when he had 31 in the first quarter, my mind was blown. I was like, really? I saw Bam had 31 in the first quarter, and then I saw it's against Washington. I was like, guess that makes a little sense when he's going against the Wizards. At the same time, still 31 in the first for one quarter alone for Bam is remarkable. He had, 62 entering the fourth or something along those lines? It is mind-blowing. And as I said at the top, the fact Bam, I mean, like people are going to talk about how it's one of the least efficient 70 plus point games we've ever had. That's true. He did not shoot extremely well after the first quarter. That's true. But the fact that he was capable of having a 30 point quarter, the fact he was capable of compiling enough points to be in this conversation entering the fourth quarter where the coaching staff can look at each other and the players can say, let's go for it. Let's do it. That is a testament to his development as a player, to a guy who has now taken over 5 3-pointers per game this season with the Heat, a by far career high for him, up from 2.8 last year, up from just being a mid-range guy years prior to that. He has improved his game dramatically as a shooter, as a creator, and good for him. A guy that's always been selfless, has always taken on different roles throughout his career for the Miami Heat to be in the spot. And to do it against the Wizards, I mean, Ime Udoka had that kind of crack at the Wizards after the Rockets game, saying, well, and the Washington Wizards, as part of the reason why Bam was capable of doing this. I do think it touches on the fact that maybe a tanking solution is just embarrass these horrific teams. The Wizards, this remainder of the season, the Wizards face Shai Gilgeous-Alexander on the 21st, Luka on the 30th, Bam again on the 4th of April. Go for it. Why not go for it against the Nets? They face SGA on March 18th, Luka on March 27th. The Pacers have games against Wemby, Luka, Mitchell. You scored 70 before. Go for it again. Anthony Edwards, Jalen Brunson. Why not? Go for it. It's Indiana. They're not trying to win. The Kings. They get Wemby on March 17th. Hey, Victor, they get nobody on their team. This is your opportunity to surpass Wilt. Go for 100. Like, enter the game with that plan. The Jazz, they got games against SGA, Anthony Edwards, Mitchell, 2 against Jokic. They face Luka on the regular season finale. You want to make an impression on MVP voters, Luka? Want to have a chance? Score 100. Final day of the regular season against the Utah Jazz. Go for it. So I think against these tanking teams, Tom, go for it if the opportunity is there. If you feel like you're starting hot, I would love to see more of it for the remainder of the year, Tom. But I mean, we're going to have some fun. Spice up some of these games, man, against these teams trying to lose. They want you to score. They want you to get 80.
It's amazing. I mean, it is one of those things where we're looking at, man, the tanking is so crazy, and it's already February when we had this discussion a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
What's going to happen for the next month and a half? Well, we just got it. Was Bam Adebayo. There's no Anthony Davis out there to save the Washington Wizards, and he's just going through everybody, and they can't do anything. They got to foul him. They had no option on Bam Adebayo, and what your point was about his growth as a player, unselfish guy, it's a great story. It's exhausting to do what he did. Like, for 42 minutes, having three, in the fourth quarter, especially three guys draped around him, it's exhausting. And it is important that for Bam Adebayo, how he's like a point center out there, is a lot of it was he had to create from the backcourt and then get downhill. And then once Bam Adebayo gets rolling down the tracks, it's very hard to stop him. And I think that's why Heat fans are so excited about this, is like maybe this unlocks something new with Bam Adebayo, where it is like, oh, if I can do 83, why can't I average 25 a night? And we just saw him do that. And I think we are going to see teams when they go against these tanking teams. Utah is the worst defense in NBA history. You could see another 70 plus point game, or even 80 plus or 100. Like you're saying, it's within the realm of possibility. And we know this because Bam Adebayo just did it, right? And the other thing I want to point out here is what you talk about with the league stepping in and maybe changing their policy on tanking because of this, because of these crazy high scoring nights, kind of like rewriting the history books, I think has precedent from 2024. When Luka and Joel Embiid were getting 70 plus, and Dame and Donovan Mitchell, when they were going off and there was this stretch of 60 plus games, we saw the NBA league office turn down the sliders and dial back the free throws and the foul calling mid-season. So we and Adam Silver went later that season and said, yeah, we did do a bit of an adjustment there. And the fans are liking more physicality, and people seem to be responding to letting guys play through it and not calling so many fouls. So we already know that the league office is watching these games and saying, hey, how can we correct for this, or how can we fix this so this doesn't happen again? Things might be getting a little out of control. And so I do think that if we see a number of these games, these extraordinary, like if I'm trying to think of who would be the Bam Adebayo equivalent, like if Harrison Barnes goes off for 70 points, I think we're going to have Adam Silver in the league office get together. Harrison, we can't have Harrison Barnes going off for 70. We got to stop this.
No way. Harrison Barnes. Good luck getting 30. At this stage of your career. I mean, I think for the Miami Heat as well, part of the excitement for Heat fans, and it's 6 wins in a row. And they're trending up. They're moving up in the Eastern Conference. They're tied with the Magic for the 5th seed. They're only 3 games back from the Cavaliers for the 4th seed. The Heat are trending way up. Tyler Hero playing high-level basketball right now. Norm Powell's return right around the corner. And Bam Adebayo, as you said, Tom, for years, Heat fans, it's like, if only Bam were aggressive. We're way better when we get aggressive Bam than this passive Bam. Well, Bam's improved in that regard in recent years, especially adding the jumper. Maybe this can be something for him to take forward in some tougher matchups when he's not facing the lowly Washington Wizards. But so Bam dropped 83. Most amazing thing that happened this week. Let's get into some more amazing things that happened this week in the NBA, because that same night, Bam scores 83. I'm thinking, I'm just going to watch the whole Spurs-Celtics game tonight, because it's Spurs-Celtics. Of course, Miami stole attention that night, but once again, Victor Wembanyama with an MVP-level performance. He had 39 points, 11 boards, 3 assists, and 2 blocks and steals against the Celtics. Ho-hum, typical Victor, kind of. But it feels like he's trending up as of late, as the Spurs won that game 125-116. Last 4 games, the Spurs have faced all playoff teams, Pistons, Clippers, Rockets, and Celtics. Victor Wembanyama in those games is playing 32 minutes per game. That's an uptick for him, averaging 33.3 points, 11.3 rebounds, 2 assists, 4.8 blocks, plus steals. So it feels to me, Tom, that the Spurs are ramping up Wemby for playoff-level minutes, playoff-level usage. And this speaks to your argument to me a couple weeks back about why you favor the Spurs as a team leading the Western Conference moving forward with them playing the way they are right now and what Wemby's capable of doing with more on his plate. We're getting a little preview of that right now, these last 4 games.
Yeah, it's maximal with Victor Wembanyama. Like, we're seeing this guy at the peak of his powers. I know he's 22. It's kind of crazy to say this, but at the peak of his powers, getting higher minutes, ramping up in the postseason. And look, SGA was sensational against Denver, and that team is battered just like a lot of teams in the league right now. But this full strength Spurs squad, even with SGA looking as good as he is, I feel like I'm taking them in a 7-game series. If it started today, I think I'm taking the San Antonio Spurs in a 7-game series over the Oklahoma City Thunder, because they're beat up over there. SGA, as brilliant as he's been, and it looks like he's over that abdominal strain, but the way Victor Wembanyama is playing and the guys around him are starting to hit their shots, we've been talking about it all year, how they need more shooting. They need more shooting. They need guys who can space and open up the paint for Victor Wembanyama getting downhill and operating in the paint more, which he's doing this season. But if they're not hitting their shots, I don't know if I can put them in that top tier, right? Right there with OKC. But they're hitting their shots. And Victor Wembanyama isn't playing just 25 minutes anymore. It's 35 minutes. He's going to be playing close to 40 minutes in the postseason. And as we've seen with the on-off splits with Victor Wembanyama, if he's playing 40 minutes a night, good luck. Good luck with that guy playing 40 minutes a night. So, dude, it's one of those things that I still can't believe it. When we're looking at the standings, a team as young as the San Antonio Spurs, where they're getting big minutes from rookies or sophomore players, it's stunning that they're this good this early. And that's what was so exciting about the Thunder last year, right, Kev? Was this is just the beginning. We're now saying this about the Spurs, and it just feels like this is the great rivalry that we're heading towards, is the San Antonio Spurs young players going against the OKC young players. And what's so tantalizing about this is this is just like the second inning of the game, right? We're just seeing these teams just coalesce around each other, and it feels like we have a chance to see this for the next decade, dude.
I can't help but just like giggle in excitement about the thought as you talk through it, Tom. It just makes me happy. Really, it does. Like, this is what we need as basketball fans, is this organic rivalry between players and teams. We know Victor and Chet don't like each other. that they feel up for those games no matter how much they might deny it. I mean, they're two long, freakish athletes. Of course, Victor, to a different extreme, as an alien out there, not even human. But Chet Holmgren in his own right is a sensational talent. So I hope to God we get these teams facing off in the Western Conference Finals. Spurs, Thunder, hopefully both totally healthy. That would be an epic series. And I think in part, San Antonio has separated themselves from the rest of the pack in the West alongside the Thunder, because it's not just Victor. It's not just Wemby. The one of the reasons why the Spurs were able to handle the Celtics, why Jaylen Brown got so frustrated in that game, why the Spurs destroyed the Pistons, was because of Stephon Castle. Castle, with what he's becoming, he got Brown so frustrated in that game. The reason why Brown kind of lost it, got thrown out, got really frustrated. He did think he got fouled. He probably did get fouled by Castle. But Castle, the way he fights on defense and the way he's able to mirror opponents and slide his feet and get underneath their jersey and just get underneath their skin and bother them, happens on a night-to-night basis against the best players in the world. And so we know Castle can defend. We know he can rebound. We know he brings those X-factor ingredients. But last 18 games on top of that, he's shooting 38% from three. So Castle's shooting the ball better than he ever has in his career. It's only an 18-game sample, taking only 2.5 shots per game. But that's part of what's interesting to me, because they have his three-point volume down during the stretch, and he's not taking dribble jumper threes anymore. Last 18 games, Castle's taken only 4 dribble jumper threes. On his first 37 games of the season, he took about 1 per game, 35 total. So they've basically cut the dribble jumper three out of his diet entirely. They seem to be trimming his volume of threes, improving the quality of those threes, and now the percentage has improved as well. We'll see if it sustains, but Castle taking this leap, we saw him score 40 points a couple of weeks back. He's capable of raising to another level as well on both ends of the floor. And so I just look at the Spurs and I see Castle's development, Dylan Harper downhill, and Devin Vassell becoming this elite shooter that draws constant defensive attention. It's not just Wemby, Tom, and that's the thing with the Spurs team and why you're so bullish on them, and how could you not be, is the development of these other guys on the roster helping them feel more complete and catch up with the Thunder.
This is the worst they're going to be. It's the craziest thing is that Steph Castle is 21, Wemby's 22, Dylan Harper's a teenager, basically. This is the worst they're going to be. So when you talk about their development, like, if Steph Castle's adding a three-point shot now, and you're right, a lot of the threes that he's been getting are off the catch. I think the Celtics like gave up pretty much any time he was in the corner. They're like, go ahead, shoot it. And he's making those shots with regularity in a way that makes him a real threat, especially when it's off the pass. When you have Castle shooting 38% above average over the last 20 or so games, you just think, all right, is this the new norm for him, right? If you take away those dribble pull-up jumpers, which are low-efficient shots for him, and he's just taking those off the catch, this Spurs team is just so much more lethal. If you look at their game log this season, if they're just shooting 40%, if they're shooting 40% from three or better, they're 22-0. They're undefeated. They haven't been beaten when they're shooting 40% or more.
Wow.
And it's like, yeah, you're going to be good when you're it's obvious you're going to be good when you're shooting 40% from downtown, but it's that they're unbeatable. So you look at Castle, if he's a reliable three-point shooter, and Vassell, we already know he's a good elite three-point shooter, but if you get guys like Carter Bryant, or if you get guys like Dylan Harper, you get guys, Keldon Johnson is having a career breakout year next to Victor Wembanyama. It's just this like symbiotic thing where the better that they become, the easier it is for Wemby. And the better that Wemby becomes, the easier and more open shots and opportunities and less traffic they're going to see when they get downhill, because Wemby is just such a gravitational force. He tilts everything to their side of the floor. And it just feels like the Spurs, this is the worst that they're going to be. They're so young. They're 3-4 years away from hitting their primes, and they're already basically a 60-win team, Kev.
It's insane. And you mentioned Carter Bryant there in passing, Tom. Carter Bryant, I'll tell you what, man. Like, he measured at the NBA draft combine at 6'7", with a 7 foot wingspan. That's got to be wrong. Like, the dude just looks massive out there on the court. He just looks huge to me. He doesn't look like he's only 6'7 with a 7 foot wingspan. He had a end of the first quarter, and this was before I switched over to the Heat game. End of the first quarter, Carter Bryant hits a corner three, and then he picks up Jason Tatum full court, because last possession of the quarter, Tatum's going to try to get a bucket. So Carter Bryant picks up Tatum full court, fights over two screens by Kata, heavily contests the three-pointer from behind. And it's just one of those two-way moments where you're like, oh, wait a minute. The Spurs didn't just draft Dylan Harper in the lottery a year ago. They also added this freakish forward who can defend stars like Tatum comfortably. And he's been playing a lot more in recent weeks for the Spurs. The shot's up and down, but dude, like he looks like a guy to me. He looks like somebody that's going to be, he's going to have a chance to have a moment in the playoffs when he's shooting as well as he has the last month and a half or so. So up near 40% from three. And he brings all this length on defense and versatility and toughness and hustle and all the same things that he did a year ago at Arizona as a player. That's why they got him, and we're seeing why they got him. The dude's awesome. I just can't get over how many guys the Spurs have. Mm-hmm. And they're so young. I can't get over it, Tom.
They have real hoopers over there, man. Real hoopers, like guys who are happy doing the dirty work. And I think that's the lesson in today's NBA is the Thunder have a whole entire farm system of, we're going to have player development, get guys who just love to hoop, guys who just love to play defense, two-way guys who just like love the grind. The Celtics are the same thing. The San Antonio Spurs, same thing. Guys who just love to get dirty, lunch pail, blue collar type defenders who are willing to go 94 feet on Jason Tatum as a 19-year-old, as a 20-year-old. Like, that's just very rare to find, where guys who are lottery picks who are just like, I am absolutely willing to do the little things in today's game in order to win. And that's something that jumps out with Carter Bryant. And also, we talked about it, just it reminds us a lot about another San Antonio Spur with a huge wingspan coming up, who's just a very quiet guy who develops slowly, and suddenly he's winning a finals MVP in Kawhi Leonard, where it's like, it might take a little while for Carter Bryant to figure things out, but he's about all the right things right now. And so I'm not saying he's going to be a finals MVP or an all-time great like Kawhi, but that's kind of the prototype, is you get this guy into a program, a winning culture around Wemby. And just like they did with Tim Duncan, is it's so much easier to develop guys when you have a generational star like Tim Duncan and Victor Wembanyama. And I'm just so excited to watch these guys grow into these players, because, I mean, it's the same thing that we said about OKC. It just feels like we're at the ground floor of something, and it would be great if they faced off each other in the playoffs. And unfortunately, we've already seen them like 17 times go against each other this year. We don't have another one. But yeah, this is Adam Silver is not rigging playoff games to make sure these matchups happen. But I will tell you that I think all of us would want that matchup to happen. If we can please get that matchup in the postseason, the NBA needs rivalries. We need these guys, these teams to hate each other. We've lost a little bit of that in the player empowerment era because of all of the turnover around the league and players jumping from team to team. But man, this OKC San Antonio thing really feels like the next great rivalry in the NBA.
So we have the standings on screen right now between the 3-seeded Lakers and the 7-seed, or the Rockets are currently actually the 3-seed with the tiebreaker. So Rockets, Lakers tied at 3, and the 7-seeded Suns, 2 games separate 3 and 7 right now, Tom. Rockets, Lakers, Nuggets, Wolves, Suns. Which team is best equipped to beat the Spurs as a 7-seed of those teams currently in the 3-7 clump?
Oh man. I would go with Denver. I feel like Denver has the best chance of doing that. I just hope their guys are healthy, like AG and Christian Brown. If those guys are healthy, this is a game changer for them. I mean, it seems obvious, but when you got two guys who are better than role players, but if you're going to take down Wemby, I think you just have to have a super experienced playoff tested championship tested roster. And so for me, it's Denver. I feel the best about Denver going forward. I just hope they're all healthy.
We have Aaron Gordon coming on as a guest later in the podcast, and I would agree with you, Tom. Denver 1, and then Minnesota or Lakers two or in three, and then Rockets, and then Suns, I would say probably is the order for those teams best equipped. So the reason why I asked that is because one of those teams is going to be the seventh seed. It's probably going to be Phoenix, but no guarantee there. The Wolves have lost three in a row. Who knows if Denver is able to stay healthy to the finish line, they could end up the seventh seed and they might win that first play-in game against the Clippers, who look like they're going to be the eighth seed. We'll talk about the Clippers in a little bit later. And we'll be right back after this break. First, I want to talk about another amazing thing this week. SGA, now 126 straight regular season games with 20 plus points. He has a chance to surpass Wilt Chamberlain on Thursday night against the Boston Celtics. The dude's unbelievable. That game against Denver way back on Monday night, it feels like a while ago with everything that's happened this week in the league, but dude, some of those shots he was sitting down the stretch of that game, Tom, I was just like, wow, screaming at my screen watching this. I mean, he looked like a running back juking through the hole on that step back jumper for the game winner. I'm amazed by this guy. Look, I get why people didn't enjoy watching Bam. I get why some people don't like the fouling that you see SGA kind of bait with his flailing and whatnot. But I don't understand why people just can't enjoy watching the whole experience of watching SGA. He combines levels of basketball from different eras with his ability to get to the cup, his ability to pull up from mid-range, the way he's added the three-pointer this season in his career. SGA is like a culmination of all the great scorers in league history packed into one in his own original way. I love watching the dude. I can't get enough of watching SGA. And I thought that game against Denver, people say it locked up MVP for him. We'll see what happens the remainder, but it sure as hell did make him the clear favorite, man, with what he did against that Denver defense. I was just mind blown at his ability to create separation off the dribble down the stretch there, man.
It was incredible. He has a limitless combo moves, like limitless package. Wow. He has so much that he can get to. That's why I think he's the best clutch player in the game, is because you can't defend him one-on-one and have any idea what he's going to go to, whether it's a spin move, a step back, a fadeaway three. I mean, does anyone, like the Kurt Goldsberry shot chart, does anyone cover more ground on their shot profile than Shai Gilgeous-Alexander? He's just... I think that unpredictability is what makes him so lethal in clutch moments, because you just don't know what he's going to do. You have no idea what to take away because he has counters on counters on counters and these fadeaway mid-range jumpers. He had a pull up from like the baseline from like 8 feet away. When was the last time you saw like a baseline pull up in that 8 to 10 foot range? The Udonis Haslem like baseline jumper is so eradicated from the game. And yet SGA, he's like, I'm going to get to that spot and I'm going to shoot 60% from there all night long. And that's really what it is. He's shooting 60% on twos this year. And most of those are coming in the mid-range away from the cup. And so when you have a layup of basically anything you can get to in the mid-range, I'm going to be able to get that at a 60%+ shot. It's absurd. And that step back, the game winner, I mean, the one right before it too was insane at the end of regulation, the way he's able to get to his spots. I don't understand how you're supposed to defend this guy. And yeah, I think a big problem in the league is that too much of the conversation around SGA is around his foul merchant free throws that he gets. But it's the same thing with Bam Adebayo the other night. I don't know how you guard that guy. I don't know how you guard Shai Gilgeous-Alexander one-on-one. And that was one of the things that I was looking at Denver being like, are you not just throwing a double team on Shai when Chet's not out there, Jalen Williams is not out there? You're just going to let him go one-on-one on these guys? And that's what happens. He just has full command of every combo move in the book. And like you said, he's from earlier eras, like Kobe, MJ, T-Mac, Jalen Brunson. He probably is watching Jalen Brunson tape and just being like, how do I use his footwork to my advantage? He's got everything, man. He has the full combo moves at his disposal. I love watching that guy play.
I thought his quote after the game, one of the best lines I've ever heard in a post-game presser. He says, I have the answers to the tests, but I got to see the questions first. And that's what he said in response to a question about, did you pre-plan that move for the game winner? It's like, no, I didn't. I saw the way the defense was positioned, and I knew I couldn't get to the middle, so I double step back, kind of juke move back to the right. It's just the dude's unbelievable. Just absolutely amazing. Another amazing thing. Oh, sorry.
Can I real quick before we jump to the next thing on SGA? I've got a column coming out today at Yahoo that I want people to check out. Just the craziest stats around his streak. One of the things I'll tease for the audience is 126 straight games with at least 20 points. He's about to surpass Will Chamberlain. The longest streak of Steph Curry's career of 20 or more is 23 games. Okay. One of the best scorers in NBA history, his longest streak is 23 straight games of 20 or more. And if you added 100 on top of that, you still wouldn't get to what Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is currently doing, 126 straight. And there is no NBA team that has 126 straight games with at least a 20-point score. He is doing this individually longer than teams are doing right now in the NBA, which is just absurd. So go check that out. Just a quick plug on SGA and the 126 streak.
Yeah, on that note, Jokic had said after that same game, he's like, it's hard enough to score 20 points in any game, hard to do it in 10 straight games, never mind 126 and likely 127 on Thursday night against the Celtics. So another amazing thing that has happened as of late, the Pelicans have turned their season around, Tom. They're 7-3 in their last 10 games. DeJounte Murray comes back, and they're starting five with Murray, Zion, Herb Jones, Trey Murphy, Sadiq Bey is crushing. We'll talk about that in a second, but they've had their moments of this run when, boy, just one of the most disrespectful moments I've ever seen on a court, where DeJounte Murray being defended by Raptors guard Jamal Shedd, and he's defended like all the way at the half court line, and Murray just crossing over, trying to create space off the dribble. And then he makes Shedd fall, breaks his ankles. And then as he takes the three, he goes and steps over him and leans over and looks down at him. Nobody on the Raptors did anything except quickly trying to step over and say some words, but nobody on the Raptors went over and pushed Murray or jawed at him or did anything. And Raptors fans are online after seeing these photographs, after seeing these images of Murray just unbelievably disrespecting Jamal Shedd, saying, we're not tough, we're weak, we don't have an edge on our roster. I've lost respect for Scottie Barnes and Brandon Ingram and the guys on this team for not stepping up and defending Jamal Shedd, one of the hardest workers on this team. Maybe we don't actually have any dogs. And I think Raptors fans are right, because how do you let this image happen with DeJounte Murray leaning over Jamal Shedd and just teabagging him, essentially disrespecting him? You don't do anything about that? Season's over for the Raptors, Tom, as far as I'm concerned after that moment. Just season's over.
Wow. I mean, is it too late to bring back James Johnson to Toronto?
Oh God! Man, oh boy!
That guy. DeJounte Murray's not doing that. He's not doing that if James Johnson's over there. You know, if Bloodsport is sitting there on the sidelines in Toronto, that's not happening. That is exactly why Indiana Pacers got him. Yep.
I mean, look at Jamal for the YouTube viewers. Look at Jamal Shedd's face. Like, he's thinking, did that actually just happen to me? Am I about to become a meme?
Poor guy.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel bad for Shedd, man. He's a hard worker. He's a good defensive player. Just not in that moment. But Murray just
not in that moment. But what a cool story for DeJounte Murray to have that after an Achilles tear 13 months away from the game, and his team, they're playing like a real competitive 500 team right now, you know? And to have that moment, that's got to feel so good for DeJounte, you know? Just all the hours of monotony and the grind of rehab to come out and have that kind of as much of an alpha moment as you can see on a basketball court, to cross over a guy, make him fall, and then tower over him. It's just got to be the best feeling. It's one of those things where I will never, ever feel the way DeJounte Murray did in that moment. And it's one of the things that you can't recreate that. I think it is one of those things that players, when they retire, they just miss those moments. It's just you can't recreate what DeJounte Murray was feeling in that moment. And I think it is informed by he just spent 13 months away from a basketball court, and he's able to do that. Just got to be the best feeling in the world.
Oh, I know. I bet. I mean, the best comparable for me is winning a tough fight in Call of Duty Warzone. That's that's the closest I can come. That's about it. But I mean, look, the dude is tough. Murray has always been like this type of player, but to have that moment is very cool. And also to do it while they're winning. Pelicans have won 7 of their last 10 games. They have a plus 3.2 net rating with Murray on the floor, a plus 8.1 in lineups with DeJounte and Zion. And then they're starting 5 of DeJounte Murray, Zion Williamson, Herb Jones, Trey Murphy, and Sadiq Bey is a plus 16.4 with a 118.1 offensive rating, a 101.7 defensive rating. So DeJounte has really helped turn things around for the Pelicans. They don't have their own pick. So unfortunately, they're not going to be in a position where, you know, that they can get a number one pick or anything like that, despite winning. There's no situation here where they get good lottery odds on their side and good. It's not like the lottery gods are going to reward them for trying to win, I mean to say. But ultimately, Tom, we are in a spot here where they're at least winning games. The Hawks now have lower odds, so that sucks for Atlanta. But good for the Pelicans. They're playing a little bit of small ball. It's cool to see. I know your guy, Derek Queen, has really gotten squeezed here, 13, 14 yep. minutes per game coming off the bench. But, hey, you got to do what it takes to win. And good for the Pelicans finding something that's working right now. And we'll see what happens over the course of time. And as for Toronto, they gotta get themselves some personality. And Anthony Edwards, about a week ago, flexing on RJ Barrett. Nobody did anything then. Nobody did anything to after Jamal Shedd got pooped on by DeJounte Murray. Just they got to get some toughness. Moving on to something else amazing that happened this week. Cameron Payne, the same night Bam Adebayo scored 83 points. Cam Payne had 32 points on 9 of 10 from the field, 10 assists, and 0 turnovers. The Sixers won that game. But the state of Philadelphia, Tom, they are riddled with injuries at this time and absences. Paul George still suspended. Kelly Oubre out with an elbow sprain. Joel Embiid still out with an oblique injury. Tyrese Maxey now, the latest news, 3 weeks he's going to be sidelined at least with a tendon injury in his right pinky finger. So Cam Payne helping the Sixers win a game against the tanking Grizzlies, but it's not looking good overall for Philadelphia at this point, Tom, with the way they have slid down the standings. They are now the 8th seed, only 2 games up on the 10-seeded Charlotte Hornets, and the only 1 game up on the Atlanta Hawks. Both have a collective 9-game winning streak. I think by the end of these 3 weeks, unless Cam Payne has more 30-point bangers, the Sixers are probably going to fall to 10. They're probably going to be the 10 seed by the time those guys come back. And that is an interesting position for them to be in. They only will have their first-round draft pick if it falls in the top 4. But if I'm Philly, I don't know. I might rather have those 9% odds than to have a chance to get the 8 seed and get slapped in the first round. What a season from hell for Philly, man.
This is the Joel Embiid problem. It's so hard to build around this guy who's not available, and he's getting paid a max salary. And it's just, this is the plight of building around a 7-footer who's injury prone, who has had an issue staying healthy throughout his career. And unfortunately for Sixers fans, this is the bed that they made, and they got to sleep in it for the next 3-4 years. And it's unfortunate, but this is kind of the name of the game with the 76ers. Is just, when you have a guy making that much money, and Paul George, it's a totally anomaly that he's got this 25-game suspension, but I do think that, you know, he's not the most available guy either. And unfortunately, I think they're kind of stuck. This is the state of the Sixers in the sense that they are going to have an injury-riddled or an unavailability problem for the next several years. And it's unfortunate because Tyrese Maxey and Vijay Edgecombe, and formerly Jared McCain, were some of the great nucleus young guards in the league. But how can you depend on Joel Embiid and Paul George to take you deep postseason runs, finally get to the Eastern Conference Finals, when they continue to break down? And this is the story of the Sixers in the Joel Embiid area, is what if, what if, what if? And now they might miss the playoffs after they had a really nice run here at times this season. They might miss the playoffs, and at some point they might be deciding to just pull the plug altogether and maximize those odds that they keep their pick.
I think that's the best path, honestly. I think currently, as of now, like I said, they're currently the 8th seed. I think they're probably going to get surpassed by Atlanta and Charlotte before Maxey's back in three-ish weeks. They could determine, oh, maybe he needs to get surgery, out for the remainder of the year. If they fall to the 10 spot, they might be right there next to like Golden State, Portland, these teams that currently have the 11th or 12th best odds. And if I'm Philly, I can't get better than 11th. Like, you're not going to catch Milwaukee. But if you can get the 11th odds, that comes with a 9.4% chance of moving into the top four, which would mean they get to keep their pick. 9.4%, the 11th spot is all Dallas needed 1 year ago to move up to number one. It's all the Lakers needed when they moved up to number four from the 11th best odds back in 2019. We've seen teams with low odds move up before. And you mentioned how they're stuck, Tom. I think that's your only way out, really, is getting lucky on lottery night. And ultimately, this team feels stuck otherwise. And so if I'm a Philly fan right now, obviously, I'd love for a miracle. I'd love for these guys to get healthy and for them to be able to make a run. I would love that. I want nothing more than for Sixers fans to experience getting past the second round. But I don't feel like this is the year for that. And it's better off getting those odds. And I think for Philly, they're in a position right now where you have this optionality, choosing your own destiny, because Atlanta is so hot, because Charlotte's so hot, because the Clippers have turned their season around as well. So quick aside for the Thunder, the good news for them is that the Sixers are falling potentially back into the lottery. The bad news is the Clippers have moved up to the 8th seed at this point. They don't look like they're going to fall any further, with the Warriors just stinking, injury riddled as well. Stephen Curry still sidelined. They seem to be thinking the same thing Philly might be right now, trying to tank and get into the lottery, allowing Matisse Bouzelis to score 41 points this week, a career high for him. But the Clippers specifically, they've moved up to 8th. Kawhi Leonard dropped 45 points on Wednesday night, just looked purely dominant. I can't get over how Kawhi Leonard right now at this stage of his career, 34 years old, after all the injuries he's had, after the championships, after all the success, he's having the best season of his career at 34 years old, and one of the most healthy seasons of his career as well. It's truly extraordinary to watch him when he gets hot. As Anthony Edwards said after the game, with him scoring 45 against the Wolves, when healthy, he's one of the best players ever. And that's like a simple way of looking at it, but it's just the truth. It's the flat-out truth. Kawhi, when he gets hot and when he stays healthy, is one of the best scorers we've seen in recent NBA history. So good on Kawhi to have these moments, especially during a controversial year, starting out with aspiration. But I love watching Kawhi, man, and I think that game against the Wolves is one of his better ones of the whole year. He should go for 80.
Yeah. Talk about a metronome. Like, that guy, Kawhi Leonard, he's had 40 plus games with at least 20 points. That's the second longest active streak in the NBA, next to Shai Gilgeous-Alexander with 126. But like, if there's a guy who can match Shai Gilgeous-Alexander one day, it would be Kawhi Leonard. Now, I know he's at the end of his career, like on the back nine of his career, but like you said, dude, they won 6 out of the last 7 games. Shai is incredible, but Kev, you mentioned aspiration. What happens if OKC doesn't have J-Dub in the first round and they're going against the Clippers? What if the Clippers pull off the upset in the first round of the series and beat?
Not happening.
I'm saying that it would take a lot for that to happen, injuries on the OKC side. But the way that Kawhi is playing, I'm not removing that from the realm of possibility that they're going to upset a team in the first round because of how good that guy is. Kawhi, peak Kawhi, can beat anybody. And so when you've got Darius Garland back and you have the ability to have Kawhi Leonard, healthy prime Kawhi, in your pocket, can you imagine the madness in those board of governor meetings if the Thunder get upset by the Clippers with Kawhi
not
Leonard
happens.
Leading the way?
You're dreaming, Tom. You're dreaming.
Can you imagine? Dreaming. I'm just saying, as good. So you're saying, as good as they are,
not happening.
You don't see them getting past the first round. It's just a really cool story.
It's a really cool story. I don't see them getting past the first round. And by the way, I'd rather see the Clippers face the Spurs for the Kawhi versus San Antonio storyline than Clippers versus Thunder. So I'd love to see the Clippers win that first play-in game as an 8 seed. Then they get the 7 seed. Then we get Spurs versus Clippers in the first round. That'd be my preferred first round matchup. And then the Thunder face whoever. But regardless of who the Thunder face in the first round, maybe it's like a Denver, maybe Phoenix moves up to 6, maybe it's a Minnesota, but I think regardless of the opponent, Tom, the Thunder are fine with AJ Mitchell and Jared McCain in the minutes without Jalen Williams. If Williams is missing the first round, I'd go as far to say the Thunder can make the Western Conference Finals without J-Dub. I'd go that far. In part because of what AJ Mitchell has become, in part because of adding a guy like Jared McCain, and obviously on top of everything else on that roster. But AJ Mitchell's a baller, dude. First game back after not playing for a month and a half, he drops 24 points in 29 minutes off the bench against the Nuggets earlier this week, just scoring from every level of the floor, from three, mid, at rim. The dude is an absolute bucket getter, shot creator. He has become the guy that he was in college at Santa Barbara when he played himself into becoming an actual draft pick to get an opportunity in the NBA. But the fact in year two, he's taken this leap after teasing some of what he could do last year in the playoffs for the Thunder is truly remarkable. And he's made it so I think OKC can play it really, really slow here with bringing back Jalen Williams. They can be ultra conservative. Jared McCain coming there as well helps add that ingredient on top of that. So OKC, I'm not concerned. I think J-Dub, they're just waiting until he's 150% healthy before bringing him back because they get so much else on that team. So look, you'd love to have him back, but they got other guys on that roster. Like you said earlier, Tom, like the Spurs are trying to build what the Thunder had, right? With just endless guys who are ballers, love basketball, play hard. The Thunder have that too in terms of shot creators too and scorers. I mean, J-Dub out, and they're still the 1 seed in the Western Conference for basically the whole year. They've missed their second best player, an all-defensive player last year in Jalen Williams, that they've had guys in and out of the lineup. You don't see Chet some nights. You don't see Hartenstein some nights. Some nights you don't see both. And Jalen Williams, the J-Will, the other J-Dub, the other Jalen Williams, goes off for 30-plus points twice in a week. I just can't help but laugh watching the Thunder. They have so many guys, and it doesn't matter who's in there, they remain a juggernaut. I just can't get over it, this team. I can't.
I mean, watching Jalen Williams, the other Jalen Williams in college, did you ever think that he could be a 30-10 guy for the number one seed in the NBA? I never would have imagined that you could develop that guy into a scorer like he's become. And it's just the OKC way. It's like, yawn. Yeah, we got another guy who can drop 30-10 who had nothing like that profile coming out of college. He was just more like I just remember him just taking like 18 charges a game in college. And now he's like a real player and a guy that I remember watching that game and seeing on the floor. Denver had its full complement of players for the first time in a long time. Just all their guys, Christian Brown, AG, and Jamal Murray and Jokic out on the floor, and SGA is looking around and he's got Jalen Williams, Isaiah Joe, AJ Mitchell, and Lu Dort on the floor in the closing moments. Crazy. And I'm like, dude, on one hand, it just shows the greatness of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, that he's able to go toe-to-toe with the Denver Nuggets, championship Denver Nuggets, with their full complement of players. And it's another just how good Daigneault and the organization is at finding guys that can hang and support SGA and just be 29 and 12 from Jalen Williams in that game against Nikola Jokic and the Nuggets. That's insane. Kev, it's insane.
Absolutely nuts. I mean, Jalen Williams, there was a moment, I think 2 years ago and last year even, I was like, well, hey, if the Thunder can upgrade anywhere, maybe it's the backup center spot. But Jalen Williams is so good for chemistry, so lovable. They can't get rid of him necessarily. But maybe that's the spot to upgrade. And then you see the way Jalen Williams has developed as a player. It's like, well, Thomas Sorber, you might be waiting for a while, even after you recover from your injury, to get some minutes. But it's a story for another day, Tom, with Sorber being a guy to replace Hartenstein someday. But ultimately, OKC, San Antonio, clearly the two favorites in the Western Conference. We talked a lot about the West today. We'll talk a lot more next week on the Kevin O'Connor Show. And Tom, you have the big number every Wednesday as well with Dan Devine. I've got a lot of draft stuff coming in the next few days. We're doing a Selection Sunday live show on Sunday, live streaming on Yahoo Sports, and I think both Yahoo NBA and Yahoo Sports. So be sure to check that out, where we'll be talking about some of the key draft matchups to watch in the first round, what we'd want to see potentially in the second round as well, in addition to all just straight up college basketball talk as well. So that's going to be Sunday on Yahoo Sports. What do you got going on this weekend, Tom? You doing anything fun?
Well, I was planning to go watch the Demon Deacons play against UNC tonight, but they lost to Clemson last night. I was at the game because it's here in Charlotte. The ACC tournament's here in Charlotte. So I went and got to watch the Deacs last night. But I won't be able to root against, you know, UNC without Caleb Wilson. Would have been nice to have that opportunity to go deep in the tournament. It's not going to happen for my Deacs. But yeah, I've got Blazers games. You know, the season, they have the softest schedule going forward. We talked about earlier about how the standings are looking for dropping for Philly. The Blazers have the easiest schedule going forward, and so they got a lot of opportunities here to add some wins going into the postseason. So yeah, go check out. We had Damian Lillard on the third quarter in the last game. It was super fun. But go catch us on League Pass if you're watching the Blazers this week, and I'll be on.
Well, up next on the audio podcast, we have Aaron Gordon, talked about his development as a player in the Nuggets as well, with what they are hoping to do moving forward this season. All right, now joining me from the Denver Nuggets on behalf of Sacks, Aaron Gordon. How are you doing today?
What's happening, yo? Thanks for having me on.
So you guys, Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray, have only played 250 minutes together this season. But past week, it's been good to see you guys back on the court together. How's it feel being back on the court finally after an extended absence this season?
Oh, it feels good. You know, we got to find that rhythm again together. But we're a very dynamic combination of players that bring a lot to the table and bring different things and same things, and I think we complement each other, all of us, very well. So yeah, it's good to be back with the guys.
I mean, you talk about finding the rhythm. You guys this season have a 130 offensive rating, 106 defensive rating, a plus 24 net with the three of you on the floor together, but it's only been those 250 minutes. So still got the month plus to get back in rhythm, and hopefully along the way get Peyton Watson back too, who's also still out. Peyton Watson, in the time Jokic was out, took a big leap. What did you see from Peyton Watson the time that both you and the Joker were out?
I mean, nothing surprising to me. P. Watson always had the potential. You know, he got that it factor. And, you know, he stepped up, and the preparation that he put in, the work that he put in the summertime, it came to fruition. So. He's an instrumental role to our team. And that's the one thing about us is we're a team. You know, we're not obviously it's predicated on Joker, but it's not predicated on just one person. You know, it takes the entirety of our team for us to be successful.
I mean, all you guys can do different things. And like when there's more important on your plate, people can. Jamal Murray is taking a big role this year, best season of his career. You have the best scoring season of your career. We'll talk a little bit about that in a second. But I am curious. This was the longest in-season absence of your entire career. And so watching from the sideline, did you learn anything new? Did you pick up any new insights having that time watching from the sidelines?
Yeah, just some of the details. Also, it's easier to say things than to do things in this league. I'll tell you that much. You know, everybody's an expert from the sideline until they get in the game. And then once you get in the game, things don't typically go according to plan or how you foresee them going usually. So just giving guys grace. Yeah, just kind of seeing it from a coach's perspective.
Was there an example of that where it's like something you might have noticed and you might have made a comment or something like that as a suggestion, as you, like you talking about things that always go as planned when you're watching from the sideline?
Yeah, just guarding other players. You know, guys are fast, guys are quick, guys are good on the court. You know, turning the ball over, taking care of the ball. You know, some unforced errors that you think you wouldn't make. You go out there, and then unfortunately, it's just part of the game.
So I mentioned Peyton Watson's development, everything he was doing on ball this year, the shooting improvement, and I feel like you're one of the best player developmental stories in the whole league. Your progress over the years, you added layers throughout your entire career, and before last season, you shot 32.3% from three, 68.3% from the line, and since last season, you're up to 41.9% from three, 80.3% from the line. Can you get into with me some of the technical stuff, the mechanical things you did to improve your jump shot to become such a knockdown guy?
Well, mechanically, I think I sped it up. I got my hand under the ball and behind the ball a little bit better. Made it less hitchy, you know, more fluid. But I think for every time I've been in the playoffs, I shot the three at 40%. You know, so what it comes down to, I'm a gamer. Even when I was back in Orlando, I was shooting three at 40% in the playoffs. So, yeah, I had some down years, especially early. As a rookie, it was tougher. The length of the three-point shot was giving me problems. But I've always shot the ball well when I needed to shoot the ball well, you know. But a lot of repetition, a lot of free throws. I think being comfortable at the line was a big jump, you know. Free throws are kind of awkward. You know, they're out of rhythm. There's stoppage of play and everybody's watching you do what you need to do. So once I got over that as well, that helped me as well.
I mean, yeah, you shot 39% from three-point range on the Nuggets finals run. You shot 41% the year after that, 38% last season. So you've always have shot the ball well in the postseason, as you said. You said you sped it up. You got behind the ball a little bit more and less hitchy. Was there a coach you worked with, a new coach you worked with to make those improvements in recent years?
I've worked with a ton of coaches, you know, and I've worked with a lot of great basketball minds throughout my career. So it was just accumulation of all of that and then putting it all together. Just putting it all together and making it flow.
Why was it important for the shot to be sped up? What's like the logic behind that?
Less time to think. You know, when you catch the ball and just shoot it rapidly, you don't think about it so much. You know, when you take your time and you kind of look around, it's like, okay, should I shoot it? Should I not shoot it? Okay, should I get my elbow in? You know, there's a lot of like tinkering that can be done within the time where you can just catch it and shoot it. So if I have all day, now I'll take all day to shoot it. But for the most part, I'm going to just fire it.
I know earlier in your career, you talked about kind of the mental side of working on your shot. And of course, meditation's always been a thing. You just did your meditation series, right? I'm pretty sure, right? It's always been a thing for you, the mental side of the game. But was that an aspect of it all the last 2 years, taking this leap from, you know, average shooter to good shooter to great shooter?
Yeah, just the preparation, knowing that you're going to go into the game shooting the ball. You know, guys were leaving me open, and I knew I could shoot the ball, so it was just a matter of being ready for it and preparing to fire the ball, and preparing to shoot and knowing that the ball's coming to you. Right. And then just caring a lot less about misses and makes, not putting so much pressure on each shot. It's just basketball at the end of the day.
Did you see that quote recently from Zion Williamson where he talked about how he doesn't like to shoot because he hates to miss and he doesn't want to feel like he's letting his teammates down? Was there ever a time in your career where maybe you sort of felt that way when it came to shooting, whether it was college, high school, or early career in Orlando?
Not really. You know, I was going to fire it. I was going to shoot it regardless because in my heart of hearts, I knew that I was a shooter of this magnitude and capable of shooting the ball like this. So there was nothing that was going to deter me or stop me from as many misses and as many failures as I needed to do and as many failures as I needed to have to be successful with shooting the ball. You know, I wanted to round my game out completely and be a complete basketball player. And that was a part of my vocation as a ball player and as a person. And so there was nothing that was going to stop me from eventually cracking the code. And it's something that you work on daily. It's not, you know, you got it one day and then that's it. You know, you don't got to work on it anymore. It's like enlightenment, you know, just because you're enlightened doesn't mean you have to stop your spiritual journey. And basketball has been a great spiritual journey. And so I think my advice to Zion is like, you know, you got to go through that. You got to go through that uncomfortableness. You're actually doing a disservice to your team by not shooting the ball.
How do you avoid that complacency that you're kind of hitting on when it comes to trying to round out your game when you've made tens of millions of dollars in your career and had great success, won a championship? How do you maintain that edge, that desire to keep improving?
That's a good question. I mean, there's a book called Chopping Wood and Carrying Water, you know. It's a great book about just consistency and the repetitive nature of accomplishing goals. And I think basketball isn't going to be around for me forever, you know, at some point in time. Or playing the game of basketball isn't going to be around for me forever. At some point in time, I'm going to have to lace my shoes together and throw them over a telephone wire. It's just about maximizing the moment, you know, and the journey that I have with basketball and giving everything that I can to it while I can.
This season with Denver, you're scoring 1.2 points per isolation. That's one of the better marks on the whole NBA and the best of your entire career, according to Synergy Sports. And it's also triple the frequency that you're using the isolation of any other time in your career as well. So it's higher volume, higher efficiency when you're operating out of ISOs. Has the jumper improved your ability to create for yourself off the dribble?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, so these days, I'm just looking for space to shoot the jump shot, you know. So I just want to create a little bit of space just so I can shoot my shot over the top. And I think teams are starting to see that. So they're starting to press up on me. And so now I can dribble by and use my athleticism. But I'm still looking to shoot the jumper even when I get by.
When I asked you initially what went into improving the shot, I thought you were going to say it's my sponsorship with Saks Underwear that has opened up my shot for me.
It definitely helped to keep me comfortable, I'll tell you that much.
Can you tell me about what you're doing here with Saks?
It is it's a partnership with Saks Underwear, Saks brand. And yeah, I think it was just a really natural fit. I was wearing Saks before we even like got together, you know, before we even had a mutual agreement of working together. So it was kind of like a full circle moment. And they're the best underwear out. And I'm not just saying that because, you know, they're paying me. I was wearing them before they were paying me. So yeah, it's a good fit.
You've had some downtime this year, more than usual. Have you watched much Arizona this season, as amazing as they've been?
A little bit. Yeah, I watched a little bit. Who did I watch them play? I watched them play BYU against AJ. They just played Colorado, actually, and they're doing really well. Number two. So I think they could probably get it done because there's not the pressure of them being undefeated. You know, they've taken their lumps. So I think they can get it done.
You mentioned that BYU game. I don't, if I remember correctly, Koa P didn't play in that game, but what have been your thoughts on him?
I haven't got to see him a lot because he's been hurt, but people have been saying that there's like Aaron Gordon similarities.
So there is. I mean, he's got the similar length and muscular frame and athleticism and can handle. He just can't shoot. I mean, like with you in college, you were like a 35-36% guy from three, but hackable at the free throw line. I mean, it's true. You've improved dramatically. It was a struggle at the line for you at Zona. Were you in your head at that point at Arizona? Yeah. Was that part of it?
Yeah, oh, I see. It was. And I had to go to like dark places to try and get myself out of there. So.
I mean, but yeah, he's got everything except the jumper. That pretty much at this point.
Trust me, if he believes, it's absolutely developable.
How about Braden Burries? Have you watched much of him?
One more time.
How about Burries? Have you watched much of him?
I haven't really watched much of him. I don't watch much college basketball, to be honest. I watch a lot of NBA. I mean, if the guys are good enough, I'll see him eventually.
That's true. You'll be playing against them or with them potentially, right? in those cases. I mentioned in passing your meditation series earlier. What was that, like a multi-part, you narrating meditation? What was that?
Yeah, it was a partnership with UC Help. Just for mental health, essentially, you know, just with all the craziness that's going on in the world. Giving people an outlet to calm down and relax their nervous system. I actually did a mental training program when I was younger, kind of around college to my rookie year, called Lucid. So I had already had like voice training in that field and like mental and sports psychology. So it worked out. It was nice, and I got some good feedback on it.
How did meditation get introduced to you? I mean, were you young when it happened?
Yeah, this guy named Graham Betchart out of the Bay Area. He was kind of like a guru. Essentially, he got introduced to me through the term next play. And the next play is actually very philosophical if you break it down. It's about just being in the moment. And when being in the moment is very like Eastern philosophy, not so much Westernized. Westernized is always like, what's next, what's next, what's next, what's next? And it was more about what's now. And from there, it just kind of like, that was like the thread that I started pulling to unravel all of the meditation for me.
Can you describe the difference, between the next play, right, and the next now philosophies you're talking about?
Yeah, usually the more present team wins, the more present player is the one that wins. So during a game, a ton of stuff happens. You miss a shot, you turn the ball over, the ref misses a call, you get fouled really hard. And if you're thinking about the missed shot, the turnover, the missed call, and you're not thinking about the play at hand, then you're going to get beat. You know, somebody's going to dribble by you and lay the ball up, or you're not going to get back on defense, or you're going to have a mental error or a lapse. So whoever has the quickest next play speed, whoever can get over the last play and get back into the moment, back into what they're supposed to be doing now, is usually the best player and usually the team that's going to win.
How has that mindset also kind of helped you in life? I mean, obviously, you know, we don't have to get into it. You've been through a lot in your own personal life as well. You lost your brother. How does that philosophy kind of help you in daily life, even aside from being on the court too?
Just being in the moment. It's everything in life. The next is yet to come. What's already happened has already passed. It's in the past. So being in the moment, and usually in the moment, everything is pretty okay. And okay is okay.
For people, I mean, I'm sure there's some people listening to this podcast that feel anxiety or anxiousness over whatever it might be in their life, what's happened or what's coming. What kind of advice would you give for those people for how to develop this approach, this mindset in their life?
Just like meditate, close your eyes for 5 minutes and just try and feel your body through your toes to the top of your head. Pick a goal. If you're goal oriented. So you have a reason. And then let it go and get back into the moment and then just start doing things daily to work towards the goal. Be singularly tracked mind. Don't be so fragmented. And that usually helps out too.
Why is that important? Not being fragmented, being singular minded.
Oh man, because you're just like, you're grasping at straws. If there's so many different things that you're trying to accomplish at one time, you can't give a concerted effort into what you're trying to accomplish. So, and it can be large goals and grandiose goals, or it can just be simple day to day goals. But pick a goal for yourself, and then you know, do what you can do. And trust that you're going to accomplish it.
Was there a time in your life where you did feel anxiousness, like anxiety, that kind of pushed you towards accepting meditation? I'm just curious, like, or have you always been wired like this? You know what I mean?
No, I mean, that was partly why I was pushed to this, is because I was so nervy. You know, I was just so nervous. I go to the free throw line and shot like 44% from the free throw line, just because it was just nerves, you know, and anxious, you know, so... if you're inclined to anxiety, this is for you. You know, if you're not, probably good. It's usually the people that want it don't need it. The people that need it don't want it, but you know, you can seek it out.
Would you kind of think about it like obviously you can lift weights and get stronger. Is it like lifting weights for the mind, like strengthening the muscle of the mind? Is that the way you kind of think about it?
Absolutely. And your attention span, everything is so instantly gratifying these days. Especially with social media and Western civilization, everything is so fast. You know, you touch a button, Instacart, Uber, whatever you want, you know, it's at your fingertips. And it's kind of like conditioned people to miss out on the fulfillment of delayed gratification.
We get everything as the moment we want it nowadays. And there's like almost kind of no patience for what takes months or years for something to come to you. I forget who it was I talked to years ago. I forget which player it was. I think they were entering their rookie season or entering their second year. And they're like, I know where I'll be in year 8 isn't where I am today. Like mm-hmm. There's an acceptance of having to be patient for those things to come your way. I think that's a healthy mindset to have no matter what you're doing in life.
Yeah. Absolutely, especially when it comes to something like basketball and pro sports and the creativity of it, you know, because I really believe that basketball is like a creative, like artistic medium, and you can't rush it. You know, it's not something that you want to rush, or it comes out undercooked or just kind of like, yeah, not as fine or refined, you know, so it's something that you want to like slow cook.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for joining me today on behalf of Saks Underwear. Congrats on all your success, man. Like I said earlier, your development throughout your entire career. I loved you at Arizona as a prospect, but what you've become is pretty amazing to see. And I know you won't stop getting better either, even at this stage of your career. So keep it going, man. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Kev.
Big thank you to Tom Haverstrom and Aaron Gordon for joining me on today's episode. Thank you to Emmy and the team for producing today's show. Thank you to Father John Misty for the music. Hope you have a good weekend, everybody. Like I said, I'll be back on Sunday live talking about Selection Sunday. So looking forward to that. Enjoy your weekend, y'all.